Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello. Nick, we don't have very many of these left, so we got to take advantage of it. Suck the marrow out of it, as it were, which is an interesting expression that doesn't get used nearly frequently enough, in my opinion. How are you doing?
A little off-putting. I think suck the marrow out of it was dead for a reason. And if that's the hill that you're going to die on, that's the lowest hill I've seen. And Terry, let me just tell you this. Inside of us, there are two people. One is David Goggins and one is Johnny Manziel. And me and my broadcast partner, Cooper Perkins, great guy, we say, is this week going to be David Goggins? Is this week going to be Johnny Manziel? This has to be a David Goggins week for me. Not only did life update, signed a new lease, going to be moving into my place, which means that I have to pack a bunch of stuff up, and I hate moving more than anything in the world, but it's going to be a nice little spot. And open invite, hey, if you're listening to this and you want to come out to Boise, Idaho, hey, you got a guest room to stay in. That's big for me. Second, was on ESPN2 for the second time in my budding career last night. Very interesting and intense game between the San Diego Seals and Colorado Mammoth. And third, Terry, and this is now relevant to the tailgate, really cool because over the course of the season, a lot of things can get lost. You know, I fully admit, hand up, last week I was like, I kind of hit a wall. Don't really need to, you know, I got to pretend to be excited. But in the slew of my social media feeds, it's really cool to see the senior days. Senior days are just awesome. The people that dedicated three hard years, whether they played, whether they didn't, whether they've had success, whether they haven't. The pictures on senior days had me reflecting on just how appreciative we should all be for these young athletes. It's a great chance to step back and say, hey, regardless of how the seasons have went, lacrosse is a sport that's worthwhile and worth playing because you develop lifelong friendships, partnerships. And to all the seniors that are at the end of your journey, whether your season ended this past weekend or whether you have a conference tournament or, playoff run that you're preparing for, thank you for putting in the time and the energy. I hope your work in the lacrosse community doesn't stop after you graduate college, and I hope you work to grow and get kids excited and leverage your experience to get the next generation excited. That's why I'm excited.
So that's a really, really touching explanation, but it is so self-centered because my favorite part about it is I'm going to speak to the percentage of the audience that's listening to this that for whom senior day is actually for. Like, for the seniors, they're just looking forward to life after college. I mean, they have their entire lives literally in front of them. Well, senior day is really for the parents, and particularly if you are a parent who had a kid who was a senior this year and you've had multiple college athletes and this is your last one, I mean, I will pour one out tonight for you because I can only imagine the tears and emotions that went into this past weekend or however recently your senior day actually was. Like, Nick, I know that your parents are familiar with this vibe as well because, you know, that is, I think that whenever I talk to the parent of a high school athlete who wants to go through the recruiting process and we talk about the cost benefit, right? The real costs, the monetary costs of club sports or whatever else that goes into it. One of the things that I always point out is if your kid goes away to college and doesn't have an activity that brings you to campus, for all intents and purposes, they've moved out. You're an empty nester. But if your kid goes to college and has a reason for you to go there multiple times a year throughout their 4 years, it really is like an extension of high school. You get an opportunity to spend time and continue to see them develop on a, you know, every couple weeks, months basis over the course of those 4 years. You get to meet their friends and you get to meet their friends' parents. All those things happen in high school, but for the majority of NARP parents, that doesn't happen. And that is where there's so much value. And so, you know, I'm going to give a shout out to all the senior parents who got to walk and the moms who got their corsages and, you know, the dads who didn't get anything because that's what happens for dads, but got the satisfaction of seeing their kids' college athletic career come to fruition.
Dads get one of the best beers of all time, and that has to be your son's senior day beer in the parking lot before you walk out. That's what we're fighting for here. And listen, it wasn't self-centered. It was just tailored at a different audience. And that's why you come to the tailgate. You get young, fresh, handsome, good-looking, probably going to lose weight here soon, Nick. And then you get old geezer thinking about the parents and tugging at those heartstrings, Terry. And I think it was Donald Trump that said, it takes a village, or Hillary Clinton, depending on which one. Whatever one pisses you off more, that's the one that I now associate that line with. But thank you to everybody that's involved. Thank you to parents, players, siblings. Thank you to AB InBev. Thank you to Molson Coors. Thank you to Tito's for supporting the parents throughout this entire year. Great call out. Should we talk about lacrosse now?
Nick, yes, let's dive right in. We're recording this on Sunday afternoon as Virginia runs out the clock on what appears to be a 12-8 victory over Notre Dame, and I know that you just landed, so I will speak to this one a little bit. The first half was a back and forth affair, and Notre Dame scored first in the second half. Kind of felt like they were in a position to take control of the game, and then I think the turning point was a Jack Taylor hit on Noah Chismar right around midfield with about 10 minutes to go in the third quarter. And typically when you see a big hit, it ends up firing up the team that delivered the hit. In this case, Jeff Conner comes up with the ground ball, throws it ahead, Virginia scores on the fast break, and then that sparked a four-goal run that I believe they ended up taking an 8-5 lead on, and then they've essentially just kind of kept or extended that lead over the course of the last, you know, 25 minutes of the game. So here we are basically in this what's the snake that eats its tail? All I can think of is Aurora Borealis. That's not what it is. But anyway, in terms of both the ACC and in terms of the top of the bracket forecast, because you've got Virginia with two wins over Notre Dame with a win over Duke, and Duke with two wins over Virginia. So essentially the question is, what do you do with that? And the answer is, I don't know. But for the end of the season, you know, we got 1 week left. Notre Dame heads to Chapel Hill to take on Carolina. Virginia's done. Duke ends their season on Selection Sunday with a neutral site game against Merrimack. It had the opportunity to be so clean, and it's just not. It's very, very messy. So thanks a lot.
I also will say one of the things that impresses me most about Virginia is their ability to manufacture wins. Because exactly like what you just said, I watched the game for about 5 minutes while I was preparing for this. And I wish this was not as tied up as a podcast, because I think it would be funny to tell you how I watched it. But it was Virginia capitalizes on those momentous opportunities, whether it was the one that you just talked about or in the 5 minutes that I saw, it was a miscommunication that should have led to a Pat Cavanaugh goal. Goaltender makes a great save, transition the other way. Great shot by the Virginia short stick, Dimitti. I was watching it without audio, so I can't remember who it was. But Virginia seems to have these times throughout the game where you think it could be not only momentous for Notre Dame, not only potentially game-changing, but reflecting back on the first game, the start of the second half, Virginia not only being able to weather the storm, but being able to come out and throw a haymaker right back. And on a more micro scale, Pat Cavanaugh, clearly one of the best shooters in college lacrosse and one of the best players, stuffed transition the other way. And I feel like Virginia does that as good, if not better, than anyone else, taking what should be momentous opportunities for the other team, turning it into positives themselves. Which just has, you know, if I'm Pat Cavanaugh shooting that and then it leads in a goal the other way, it's just like, dude, like that needed to be a goal or at least not a negative. And Virginia capitalizes on those opportunities. And I think it's why Virginia is probably, the scariest team going into it, because regardless, and we've talked about this, of how well you play them in some sort of facet of the game, they will find ways to manufacture it, lure you into their game in certain parts and capitalize.
No question. And I think that that's why, you know, people say something along the lines of Virginia is Virginia, or they, you know, isolate or focus on the talent. And it's because it feels like it's so dismissive of the quality of coaching that is necessary in order to harness that talent. But at the same time, other teams aren't able to go as quickly from bad play to good play as what you just described, because, I mean, simply put, like, either, you know, there's just one, at least one chain link missing, or one link missing in the chain. You know, are you fast enough? Is your handle good enough? Is your creativity and risk tolerance high enough? Whatever the case may be. And the fact is that, you know, they've lost three times this season, in overtime at home to Maryland, and then in two games against Duke. That Duke regular season losing streak is so bizarre that it almost feels mystical in a way that it shouldn't really count. It kind of needs to be thrown out, which is invalid. You can't do that. But if your choice is how dominant, I guess, was Virginia, or how, you know, how securely did they control their wins versus Notre Dame, in contrast to how securely did Duke control their wins versus Virginia, and then how do you contextualize Notre Dame's win over Duke? Like, my point is, it's just a mess. There's no, you got, the only way you can sort it out is to make a choice at some point, and it's going to be the best of bad options, and just kind of be comfortable with it coming away from it. And if your argument is when their ceiling is the highest, when they're playing their best, they are the most dangerous, like, I can accept that. That seems like a good argument. A couple things I want to point out or call out about this game before we move on. The Chris Fake Connor Schellenberger matchup was going to be one that was very closely followed after the way in which the first game unfolded and what Chris Fake had done in the intervening weeks since then, particularly as we analyze Schmeisser Award and First Team All-American Awards and stuff like that. And Schellenberger finished with a goal and three assists. I thought one of the most notable plays was when this was a really weird and interesting choice that Virginia made. So first they got a switch and Schellenberger pulled out Ben Ramsey. Then they brought a shorty, like another. So it was a little pick, and they switched him on to Quinn McCann. And I thought that was head scratching, just because isn't Ramsey the matchup that you want to attack in that scenario? You already did the work to get the switch. Why did you do the work to get another switch onto? I mean, it's a two-way midi. I get it. He's not Nick Harris, who I think Notre Dame regards as their number one short stick. But still, like, I don't know why you want to attack Quinn McCann. Either way, he stood him up, and Fake came flying over with a double and dislodged the ball and caused a turnover, and it went the other way, and Notre Dame got a possession out of it. So, you know, not necessarily like a win that nullifies the goal, so to speak, but whatever. And then there was a play late in the game. It wasn't decided, but it was, you know, Virginia was in kind of ball control, game control type mode, and they were going after a ground ball. Fake knocked the stick out of his hand, then got a playing without a stick call on Schellenberger. So, you know, even though I guess my point is, this wasn't a bad defensive performance, I don't think, either from Fake or Notre Dame in general. I thought that it was a really good goaltending game out of both ends of the field, better out of Nunes. And really the reason that they won, so to speak, or the most important aspect of the outcome was the way in which Virginia's defense limited Notre Dame's offense, particularly from the midfield, which then put a lot more pressure and sucked up a lot of space that the attack otherwise would and should and usually does exploit, that just wasn't there. So, you know, I thought Cade Sostad played well. I thought the broadcast did a nice job of noting that and calling that out. And yeah, like I said, I mean, it's just, I feel like it's impossible to draw a conclusion from this game, except for the fact that we've got three teams that are roughly equivalent at the top of the bracket, and one of them's probably going to have to go through the other two, and one of them's going to avoid the, you know, kind of, one of them's only going to have to play one. So whoever gets the one seed is going to have a pretty significant advantage. It'll be exciting to watch. Definitely shaping up for an interesting match.
Let's hear your top three. What's your prediction? Actually, no, not even what's your prediction, because that's you guessing on how other people are going to ask. You're the head of the committee, and you have nobody that can disagree with you, how do you seed the top three?
So I actually do want to make a prediction. My prediction is that they're going to make a decision about either their three hinge places on the bracket. Number one seed, number eight seed, and last team in, right? So you make so who's in contention for the number one seed? And I think it's fair to say Duke, Virginia, Notre Dame. Who's in contention for the number eight seed? Obviously, we need to see the data continue to develop. Right now, it's probably the combination of Cornell Penn Yale and Georgetown, maybe Villanova, but probably not. It's probably just like of those four teams, Cornell Penn Yale and Georgetown, two of them are going to be the 7 and 8 seed, and two of them are going to be the first two unseeded teams. And then you have the last team in, and that's probably where we get to, you know, it's really hard to say, is Carolina going to be in the conversation without knowing how the Notre Dame game unfolds? And it could end up being the case where the bubble ends up getting very small and it's basically two teams for one spot. But my prediction is that the committee is going to deal with the number one seed last. So they're going to take whatever is the justification they use for one of those other two hinge decisions and then protract it over the other two hinge decisions that they have to make, as opposed to using the number one seed as the first decision. And if they decide we're going to go with RPI,
bottom
using
up
RPI
top
for
down.
The other two decisions. Yeah, exactly. For me personally, the logic of the three teams within that, like just the three teams, is Virginia.
Get there.
It's got to be Virginia, Notre Dame, Duke. I think it's got to be Virginia, Notre Dame, Duke. But obviously, how do you justify Duke beating beating Virginia twice? But I don't think you can do that because Virginia is the team that has the loss outside of the group. And so to the extent that they represent a tier and they've got a loss to a team below the tier, I mean, obviously Duke has the loss to Jacksonville as well. So
yeah, and it's for that exact reason. Is Duke has the worst loss in Jacksonville, and Virginia has the only loss that's not Duke or Notre Dame. And yes, Virginia has two wins over Notre Dame, but I just feel like looking at the losses is always where I kind of start as far as who has the lowest floor, not who has the highest ceiling. So I think Virginia's loss to Maryland is more substantial than their two wins over Notre Dame and Notre Dame not having a loss outside of Virginia. And also one more point. And Notre Dame having a Maryland win. And, you know, let's not forget last year, I still haven't forgiven Donna, so maybe they have a chance to right their wrongs and give Notre Dame the number one seed after the corrupt organization that we needed to drain the swamp last year needed to come back. But I'm going to put that aside, and instead I'm going to focus on something. Terry, I'm an environmental guy. I care about the environment. And I would, the only time I'm would be a fan of burning plastics and releasing a lot of carbon and greenhouse gases would be lighting Virginia's helmets on fire. This Notre Dame Virginia game is fantastic. I couldn't get over it. I almost didn't even want to watch it because I hate their helmet design. And I think that was the ultimate factor that had them going number two as well, is pure aesthetics and people wanting to tune in for a good matchup and not going, wow, nice. Look at this clown car that crashed in Charlottesville and then dumped out a bunch of stuff and now Virginia's wearing it. So, and that's another reason why you come to the tailgate is Terry's great analysis and then my even better analysis that their helmets are stupid and they lost to Maryland.
I do love all white two-color uniforms because when Maryland had those, I think it was in the 2017 season, I thought those were like so crisp as well. I don't know. It's so rare. They look like pajamas almost. It's very bizarre, but I like it.
All right. Well, we'll see how those predictions play out. If I'm right, I will be sending you a text, nana, boo-boo, something very, very juvenile as I'm known to do. But let's dive into some other games, and we'll start with the Ivy League. I feel like this was, I would say, the game of the weekend. Cornell, Princeton, and what
I think many others would as well.
Yeah, I think so too. And this was a good weekend that represented kind of the season. Just good game. This season has consistently delivered, and very few times can I remember a stinker of a weekend. So during a week, during a season, which every game delivered, Cornell-Princeton, which saw the Big Red clinch the Ivy League regular season title 14-13 in overtime. And quick tangent, is there anything more meaningless than a regular season title when you have a conference tournament? Debate amongst yourselves at home and enjoy that debate. So the story of this, just like we were talking about fake Schellenberger, was Gavin Adler matching up against Coulter Mackesy, and Princeton's offense goes through him. If you just look at the statistics, you shut him off, there's a very high chance that you shut Princeton down. And Adler secured a decisive win in the matchup, holding him to 0 goals and 0 assists, which is one of their performance, like one of the defensive performances of the year, in my opinion. But Princeton was still able to put up 13, so huge credit to them. And it wasn't easy for them. Cornell jumped out to a 6-1 lead. Big credit to Princeton for showing resilience even without their best player producing. And it was, in fact, Cornell who had to force overtime because they were down 13-12 with a few minutes left. So, Terry, Cornell wins the regular season title, but Princeton gets a little momentum with a solid showing.
Totally. And I think that I want to harken back to January. I was at the Adrenaline Challenge or Shootout, whichever is the one in January, which I guess I already said. And Jim Mitchell was there. And we talked about two things. Number one, I wanted his opinion on what it was their offense was going to look like without Chris Brown. To me, that was one of the most important questions of the entire offseason was, you know, no team had such a small percentage of their assists returning. And this was a Final Four team. I'm just like, what, you know, so I was picking his brain about that. And then we kind of shifted gears, and it was later, I think, in the day. So there was a little bit of separation from the prior conversation. And I was like, one of the things that intrigues me the most is when a player goes from basically not in the All-America conversation to then being a teamer the following year. And he was like, well, the answer to this, in my opinion, is kind of the same. Like, I think it's going to be Coulter Mackesy. Like, I think he's going to be the quarterback of our offense, and I think he's going to have the type of year that justifies being a, you know, first, second, or third team All-American. And not only did that come to fruition, but in my opinion, heading into this weekend, Mackesy has so when it comes to the Twarton, and we're down to 25, like, you know, nominees to be named a five, you know, one of the five finalists, I think that there's a pretty clear top four: CJ Kearse, Pat Cavanaugh, Connor Schellenberger, and Brennan O'Neill. And then I thought that there was a cluster of four or five guys who had flaws in their argument, but also, you know, tailwinds as well, to be the fifth guy. And that was kind of the way I felt throughout the majority of late March and into mid-April. But heading into this week, I thought that Mackesy had separated himself. His production over the course of the Ivy League regular season, but specifically the last like three or four games, was really eye-catching. So now it's not, so Gavin Adler's performance is not just what you described. It wasn't simply that he put the clamps on Coulter Mackesy. The thing that makes what he does so impressive is that he does that and he continues to be productive in the ground ball and cause turnover categories. So in this game, he picked up 6 ground balls and he caused 3 turnovers. For the season, he has 56 ground balls and 13 caused turnovers in 13 games. I'm sorry, 20 caused turnovers in 13 games. I mean, he continues to be so incredibly productive. And, you know, he's not underrated in the sense that he is a first-team All-American and has been basically since mid-season of last year. And he probably would have been a preseason All-American in 2022 had Cornell played in 2021. His performances in 2020 were exceptional. So in many respects, there's nothing about this that is a surprise, but it remains very impressive. The only thing is that I do think that this is a little bit of a moment for high-end close defensemen. I think that the group, and I think, you know, at the top, it's Gavin Adler, Will Bowen, and Brett Makar. And then I think there's like a slight delineation. And it kind of depends on whether you're talking about analyzing this season or you're talking about it in the context of PLL draft forecasting. But I think Owen Grant and now more recently Alex Mazzone from Johns Hopkins have entered that conversation. And that's before you get to the likes of Ajax Zapatello, Cade Sostad, and Cole Kastner from Virginia. And from there, we can continue on. We've already talked about Fake, right? There's just... Kenny Brower at Duke. There's so many high level defensive players, but at the same time, that top tier is kind of analyze them together. And there's just no argument that Gavin Adler is the most productive of the three in the combination and context of producing ground ball, picking up ground balls and causing turnovers, and then, you know, what he's able to do in his singular matchup. When you kind of open it up a little bit wider and talk about like season long defensive efficiency, then the conversation can get a little bit more equitable, but it also comes at the expense of, all right, well, now you're incorporating six or seven guys into the conversation, and it's no longer just this one individual's performance that's dictating, you know, what happens and how it unfolds. But, you know, ultimately, I think your point is well taken and you start in the right place. I think Princeton deserves a tremendous amount of credit for the guys who stepped up in the absence of Maxey's offensive production. So Lucas Stannett had 2 goals and 4 assists. Sean Cameron had 1 goal and 2 assists. Alexander Verdaro had 3 goals. I mean, just, you know, really impressive showing for guys that, with the exception of Verdaro, hadn't had that season-long consistency to this point. But I also think that it's telling that, you know, the game-defining play was Gavin Adler and Colter Maxey competing. So a ground ball at the midline. It looked like Adler missed it first time, and Maxey was going to come up with it. Adler checks the ball out of his stick and gooses the ground ball away, and then comes up with it cleanly on the second time opportunity. It was a heart flutter moment for Cornell fans, because had Maxey come up with that ball cleanly, he had nothing but space in front of him and then the goal. And it was in overtime, and it would have decided the outcome of the game. It would have decided the Ivy League regular season champion. It would have decided the number one seed in the NCAA tournament. It would have dramatically changed the Tigers' at-large resume. It was a pivotal, pivotal moment. And so, you know, I don't know if a defensive player can win the Tewarton, but if one can and it requires a quote-unquote Tewarton moment, that was it. That was about as clear as it comes.
I love the optimism that you think a defensive player could even be considered for the Tewarton, because it's always, oh, look at these 15 defensemen on the watch list, and the first 15 cut before the finals are every defenseman. So a great recap, and honestly, Adler's been fantastic to watch all year. Even as I do my best to avoid the entire Ivy League as a whole, his performances, and even when I go back and watch, you know, whether it's clips, whether it's quarters at a time, he's just fun. Like, good defense, it's just fun to watch. You know, it's like a pitching battle where you see one of those pitches where you're like, damn, I don't exactly know why that's so good. And the only time I can remember, and this is a testament to how good he is the only time I can remember one of his clips going viral, it's similar to when Lyle Thompson got twigged at X from an Army defenseman, where it was, oh my goodness, look at this defenseman, look at what they did. And it was Sam Hanley shooting over Gavin Adler while Gavin Adler was in good position. And that was kind of a semi-viral clip. Not because it was bad defense, but just because it was, oh, look, somebody was able to score on Gavin Adler. So just a testament to him. And
that was at the end of like a 15-11 Cornell win too. So I'm sure, despite that was an annoying clip to have go viral on you, he was okay with it.
Yeah, and honestly, it is interesting, because now Princeton's back is against the wall. It's got to be a win the tournament, and you're in. And you just took Cornell to the wire, who won the regular season title. So you got to have a little bit of confidence coming from that, particularly offensively. I would say is now Cornell knows, like, even when our game plan goes to perfection and we shut them off, Now we have to worry about a slew of other players, which leads us to the second Ivy League. And unfortunately, and I say unfortunate because I want to get ahead of this bias right now. My former defensive coordinator, Jerry Byrne, and one of my best friends, Will Corrigan, are the coaching staff at Harvard. So that bias will come through right now. Unfortunately, Harvard's season ended with a loss over Yale. And as far as stakes go, I don't know, and Terry, you can correct me, I don't think it got bigger than this game all weekend, because it was win and you're in the Ivy League tournament, lose and you go home. Clear cut, black and white, win and you're in, lose and you're out. And it, you know, when you get in the, you know, Yale comes out 14-11 and Harvard's done, which is a bummer for Harvard. And I say that even, again, remembering the playoffs last year in which Harvard unrightly, you know, unjustly got in over Notre Dame, but I'm going to put that aside. But the game started with a bang as Leo Johnson scored three goals almost immediately and Yale jumped out to a 4-0 start. And then that led to a 7-3 lead at the end of the first quarter. And the fireworks that ensued from Yale and the 7-3 kind of represents a nursed, maybe intentionally or not, but a nursed game with long possessions with, you know, not really the explosiveness that you saw in the first quarter. And I don't want to describe it as stall ball, but it was long draining possessions. And the first quarter was as exciting as the game got from a goal flurry standpoint, which honestly, I'm just going to say was a letdown of a game, because last year, Harvard-Yale was one of the most electric games I've ever seen. So to have this game come out and be Yale jumps out to a lead and then nurses it, you know, was a bit of a disappointment. So shout out to the Crimson, shout out to the coaching staff. Going to be a big year for them next year. That's all the nice stuff that I'm going to say. But it tees up Yale to face Cornell in the tournament. And I'll put the ball in your court. What do you think of that matchup, or what do you make of Harvard's season? You can go one of two ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think your assessment of the game is accurate in the sense that it didn't deliver the fireworks that last year's game did, because Yale scored three goals in the first 49 seconds or something crazy like that. And then from there, you know, it was a combination of extending the lead and then kind of holding on to the lead. As far as Harvard's season, you know, obviously it's got to be viewed as a disappointment. I think the high watermark was the win over Cornell. Jerry Byrne spoke to Kevin Brown from Inside Lacrosse after that, and the quote that got a lot of attention was, "We're right on schedule. If we were ahead of schedule last year, it's that we feel like we were right on schedule this year." And I think the question is, how much better were they in aggregate this year than last year, even if the results didn't go their way? And, you know, I think that there's arguments that their ceiling, their best performances were better, but that they weren't as consistent. And so the question becomes, how do you focus on improvement when the improvement is being consistently better, as opposed to raising your ceiling? I think when folks think about improvement, they think about raising their ceiling more than they think about being more consistent. So it's just a different challenge. And it's a, I don't want to call it a unique challenge, but it's a little bit of a different challenge. And so, yeah, I mean, it's, there were just a lot of kind of bizarre things that happened, you know, during this Harvard season that I think are, you know, in isolation, you can deal with them, but in kind of totality, they're hard, you know, like the Sean Jordan injury, for, you know, for instance, that one kind of strikes out to me as being, you know, the Virginia game, which was, you know, as one-sided and lopsided out of the gate as any game I saw this season. There was just a lot wrapped up into it. So, you know, ultimately, rolling it forward, I think, number one, a little bit of a reversion to the mean on the luck side. And then number two, continuing to bring in high quality recruits who, you know, are committing to this vision of the program. Not, you know, they committed to the Chris Wojcik vision of the program, and then they had to be retrofitted to the Jerry Byrne, Neil Hutchinson, Will Corgan vision for the program. So, you know, there's going to be incremental growth just on that basis alone. But again, the focus in the offseason is probably going to have to be focusing on consistency. You know, one of the things that I really kind of just noticed like a bunch of times when I was just looking at these teams' seasons and resumes and everything else that goes along with it is when you only play 12 games, your margin is so narrow, right? And I understand that A, it's hard to, you know, basically once you get beyond 12 games, you're pretty much not going to be adding a game that's going to provide value from an RPI standpoint. And if you want to add comfortable wins, it will come at the expense of your RPI. So that is a little bit of a Sophie's choice. But the combination of just winning games and feeling better about it, in addition to giving yourself more opportunities to show that you've improved. Yeah, I don't know. It's just like, and it's, and you know, I'm bringing it up in the context of Harvard, but it feels true for, you know, Ohio State, for instance. There were just a lot more teams that only played 12 games this year than is usual. And I felt like a lot of them suffered from the fact that, you know, they, in prior years when they played 13 or 14 games, had a couple of, you know, whether it was midweeks or a couple of additional games where it just like, you could put good film out there. You could get the guys feeling good about themselves. You could add an additional good week to your consistency track record. I just don't know that Harvard had enough opportunities to play well on the basis of the quality of the opponents that they had. So,
well, and it's, as far it's as interesting the, too, because Yale-Cornell didn't that matchup, well, I was just going to say, didn't that bite Notre Dame in the ass last year with the 12-team schedule? And I remember that being a big reason why, is because they lost, I think, three games early in the season and then had to play almost damn near perfect for the entire rest of the season. So if I'm a college coach, you know, it's almost interesting to see Harvard get in last year and then adopt a 12-game schedule. And, you know, this is now borderline, you know, just borderline going through and thinking conspiracy, but like, oh, because the Ivy League RPI would be much higher. Well, but because they had a down year and only had 12 games, it's almost like this inverse, the ACC this year is the Ivy last year and the Ivy last year is the ACC this year, where those Ivy League wins and games, you lose a couple and it's an uphill battle. Or were you talking more on like team morale?
Totally. Well, I'm talking about it on both fronts. Right. The issue that Notre Dame had is that they just didn't have enough opportunities to accrue quality wins or, you know, accrue enough wins. Right. You know, but we talked about it in the context of like they played the minimum. Duke played the maximum. Duke suffered from the fact that they lost these games because they played 17 games. Right. So there wasn't a clear answer. But I think that it was, again, we talked about it with Penn all year long, like, Penn is one of the most reliable bets for having a high RPI that has existed in the sport over the last 15 seasons. And it is because Mike Murphy knows how to build a schedule in order to maximize his team's chances of having a high RPI. It feels like there were, I don't know, half dozen teams that aspire to make the NCAA tournament that utilized that strategy this season. And they didn't necessarily fully account for the expense, which is a combination of you're not going to have as many games in order to get your bench it's on the field. You're not going to have as many games against teams that you can go in expecting to win, such that when you play well, it builds momentum, it builds morale, and it makes everybody feel good. And then, you know, obviously, like, if Princeton loses, they're ineligible for the NCAA tournament. Ohio State is ineligible for the NCAA tournament because they just, I mean, Ohio State was 5-7 at the end of the regular season. Now they're 5-8, right? Like, they were going to need to win to, basically, they're just going to need to win the Big Ten championship in order to be over 500. So all I'm saying is that there is a downside. There is a cost to playing an RPI maximized schedule that is sometimes not as clearly evident as the benefit is.
Yeah, it's, I feel like, and I have no clue about this, so this is yet another guess, but the way that coaches are going to craft schedules moving forward, going to be interesting. I love the way that a lot of teams did it this year with the first half of the season kind of shaking up who's going to have the leverage over in-conference RPI wins, and it breaks it into two seasons. Like, the first season is how impactful are your conference wins going to be, and then the second is can you execute on those wins. So I'm actually pretty excited to see how the Ivy League turns out. I think there might be some surprises. I think Yale's going to be sneaky, Princeton's going to be sneaky, and I don't think Cornell can coast to a title, which is something that I would have thought a couple weeks ago. But I'm getting a tummy ache, I'm getting indigestion, and it's because we've talked about the Ivy League for too long. So let's move on to the Patriot League. And I would say the second best game of the weekend, arguably, although I really am excited to talk about the Merrimack one. So Boston Army, and Boston comes away with a massive win over Army and secures the number one seed in the tournament. And this was the classic slugfest, with neither team being able to break away. And despite Army's, I would say, better performance to start and better first half, it couldn't really materialize outside of a quick two-goal lead. And so credit to Boston for weathering that storm. And I feel like Boston was very opportunistic, and they wouldn't have won this game if it wasn't for going 3-6 on men up at 50%. But also, they scored two more goals right as penalties were being released and right as Army's defense was settling in. So you take five goals on man up or just after man up, and that's a hell of a way to win the game. And Will Colletti for Army was there to make big plays when they needed it too. So it was almost Boston special teams unit versus Will Colletti in a cool little slugfest. And they both have byes, and in a rematch in the Patriot League final inevitable, and who else in the conference could make a run? So this is going to be more of a Patriot League discussion, because that tournament is set with Lafayette versus Lehigh, Loyola versus Navy, and then the winner of those games getting either Army or Boston. This one's interesting, because again, I would have put money on Army a couple weeks ago to just not coast, but certainly be the number one seed, and that is that's not true. Credit to Boston.
Yeah. So, I mean, slugfest, yes. Army on a Friday night, rainy field. To me, this one was a reflection of BU being so veteran laden and Army having to replace whatever it was, 19 seniors from last year. And obviously, it's April 28th when this game is happening. You know, these freshmen are sophomores now, and the underclassmen or upperclassmen, all that sort of stuff. I get it. But that doesn't mean that those guys have been in this particular situation before, where Boston U legitimately has been in this situation last year. Some of the guys that were in this situation for Army, like Will Colletti, were the guys who performed well. Will Colletti's bulldodge was absolutely outrageous. I talked to Ryan Poley on Saturday, BU's coach, and I think he was disappointed in his team's 10-man ride, which is a hallmark of what they are and who they are and what they do. I think he was very pleased with what they got defensively. And, you know, in terms of what this is an indicator for from a rematch standpoint, if it were to come to that, I mean, there's no way to know. For a variety of reasons, you know, the fact is that these two teams are going to be playing. All right. Well, first of all, to address your question, yeah, I mean, shout out to Pat Myers and Lafayette for getting back to the Patriot League tournament. Really impressive accomplishment for the Leopards, and show that they have done a lot of nice things in order to position the program like this. Obviously, they get their rival short trip on a Tuesday night. And, you know, I feel like we fell into this trap a little bit last year talking about St. Joe's and just routinely saying Zach Cole, Zach Cole, Zach Cole. And you know, Mike Sisselberger has been at Lehigh for 4 years now. We can say Sisselberger over and over and over again. But if you watch the Loyola game, it was Mike Sisselberger and Scott Cole. And it's going to be that only more so against Lafayette. So, you know, I'm not trying to pencil Lehigh into the Patriot League semifinals, but it's going to be a steep hill for the Leopards to climb. And then, you know, similarly, Navy takes care of business against Bucknell to close out their season. Navy has wins over Loyola and Boston U this season at home in a night game. And here we go again. Actually, excuse me, the Loyola win was in Baltimore. But the thing that I'm most interested in is Navy's offense, and specifically Xavier Arline's role in the offense. Because early on, it felt like, you know, Xavier Arline is a football player, right? We saw a little bit of this on Saturday with Dontre Trader, video of him on the sideline at the spring game talking about how he has to meet with his coaches all the time and how he goes through football lifts and everything else. You know, Xavier Arline is that at a service academy, and, you know, I don't even know whether he's like practicing as a quarterback anymore, but he's been a quarterback for the last 2 years. So he's the demands on him, and not only that, but also they have a new football coach. So the demands on him from a football standpoint have to be pretty outrageous, and they have to come at the expense, I would assume, of his commitment to the lacrosse team. And so it was easy to kind of correlate or cause, causation versus correlation, his role in the offense with their struggles when they were not playing well. And then, you know, he had a couple of goals in the loss to Army, and then he was pretty much their best player against Bucknell. And you can potentially make an argument they wouldn't win that game without him. So that'll be interesting insofar as how it manifests versus Loyola. You know, we have spoken enough about Loyola over the last two seasons where you can understand why you would be dubious or frustrated by whatever they've put on film and on paper. But at the same time, they still have championship pedigree, and they're still a team that beat Maryland and Johns Hopkins earlier this year. So I'm not going to count them out.
Loyola's season, unreal.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that team is still in there somewhere. We'll see. I don't know. The team that I saw lose to Georgetown didn't look like a team that was going to be able to go on the road and win at Navy Marine Corps Stadium.
But that I doesn't completely mean that
they're
agree.
Not going and to. So anyhow,
most confusing season, and I can't wait to do a superlatives episode with you. But most confusing season of the year, far and away, goes to Loyola, potentially Georgetown. But I can't see a team that has the ceiling that they have come out and really have a bad performance. So that might be my sneaky take right now, as we see shades of Loyola from earlier in the season and see them make a run in the Patriot League with their back up against the wall. So that's really the only Patriot League takeaway I have.
Yeah, I mean, and it's whatever. I don't want to hedge. I don't want to like equivocate. I don't want to just be like middleman the whole time. But you're right. Like, it feels as if this is either Loyola's going to make a run or it's just going to be chalk the entire way until we get to a BU Army rematch. Because it does feel like there are pretty clear lines of delineation between 1, 2, and 3, 4, and then 3, 4, and 5, 6. And if that's the case, then, you know, we should see the quarterfinals and semifinals go to seed. But I don't know. I just it feels a little too quiet. This weekend, for as good as some of the games were, didn't have enough upsets to really make me feel like our upset quotient or quota has been met. And so as a result, it just feels a little too quiet.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You see close games and you see the top dogs coming out in close games. And, you know, maybe if I'm Cornell, maybe if I'm Army, maybe I throw some of these games so that these upsets get out of the way earlier. It only makes sense. And for all you, one of the great pranks of all time is this the big statistic injury saying that correlation does not equal causation. It does. I don't know who got gaslit to not believe that and for that to be a well-known saying. Correlation equals causation. Put it in your books and argue with your stats teachers. And then when they throw numbers at you, plug your ears and go, la, 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 you're wrong. Anything more on the Big East before we – or, sorry, on the Patriot League before we head – wow, mess that up – to the Big East?
No, but let me pick it up from here because I do think a nice segue is to point out that a contender for weirdest season is absolutely Marquette. How a team loses to Bellarmine and Providence, beats Penn State and Michigan, and then loses three overtime games to Georgetown, Villanova, and Denver to have their season end at home and they're hosting the conference tournament is just...
Disgusting. I mean, disgusting. I have it in my notes right here. I have these notes that I send over to you, and here's what I wrote down. Here's what Big Brain Nick said. Big East, more like the big holy shit, when will Marquette catch a break? And so I just have...
That's a clever name. You really have you have an incredible turn of phrase there, Coach Osello.
Wow, just wit like you can't, like you, biblical wit is how I would describe that. And I couldn't agree more. Looking at Marquette's season, I legitimately feel bad for them because they don't even know who they are. Tough heartbreak after tough heartbreak. And if you're a Marquette fan, you have my condolences. And this DU game, even when DU was up 14-11, Marquette rallies back and forces it into OT. And like you said, the all-time, the biggest salt on the wound moment has to be the Big East tournament being hosted at Marquette and overtime losses being the reason that they can't participate. So, boy, if I'm a Marquette lacrosse player, I'm probably stocking up on eggs right now to throw at the buses that come in. I'm probably maybe having a Dr. Pepper or two and heckling. I got to have some sort of fun because the merry-go-round and the heartbeat monitor of a season that they just got through is just tough. And we'll start with that. Of all the teams in America, in all major four sports, have Marquette lacrosse fans have it the hardest this year?
If I'm a Marquette lacrosse player, I am going to Madison this weekend. That is what I am doing. I'm not going to be in Milwaukee this weekend. I promise you that.
Hey, you know, I couldn't. It depends. Do I want to cause chaos and do I want to, you know, call the hotel phone numbers of all the Big East players and just be an agent of chaos? Or do I want to go to Madison? You know, I've never been to Madison.
Did you ever play at Marquette?
We did. We did once, and it was... It was the quick turnaround, so we didn't get we showed up, we won, and then we got out of
drove
town,
up
so
and
I
back.
Didn't get to see anything. Yeah, I think.
So you may or may not have seen this, and somebody told me because I went in 2013, so 10 years ago now. I don't know whether this is still there, but when I was there, so Valley Fields is the athletic complex, and it's like, you know, on the other side of the river and interstate from the main college campus. And all of this is about to either be redone or go away or get replaced by the new stadium that they're building or whatever. But across the street was I believe it was Cargill meat processing plant. So intermittently, like every, I don't know, 30 seconds or whatever, you would just see the shadow of a cow carcass fall into a dump truck, like through this, like, you know, the dump truck would pull in there. It was in a bay, and there was just like light coming through it in the backside. So there's like the, you know, meat processing plant, and then you just see like this thing fall down into the dump truck. And I was like, what was that? And Scott Rogers was there. He was like, oh yeah, that's a cow carcass. I was like, okay. So I'm like constantly like trying not to look over my shoulder. It's unbelievable, dude. But get this. That's not the topper. So practice probably goes from like 2 to 4. At like 2:55, they call a water break. And then at like 2:58, I hear the first Harley Davidson start. And then I'm not exaggerating. For the next 15 minutes, it is just a parade of 500 Harleys firing up their loud ass engines and screeching out of the parking lot because it was like, you know, it was the day shift getting off of the Harley Davidson manufacturing plant that was legitimately, so it's like the meat processing plant was like right here, and then the Harley factory was like right there. It was unbelievable. It was the loudest place I've ever been for like 17 minutes, and Joe Amplo was just like, I don't know, that he was just standing there looking at me like, this is it. This is what I signed up for. And then, you know, eventually it dies down and I guess somebody else starts making Harleys and we get back to practice.
Incredible. I mean, talk about a hostile practice environment. Oh, you're worried about crowd noise? No, our eardrums are blown out from Harleys. We don't even know what's going on.
I say all that to say, it's going to be an awesome Big East tournament in Milwaukee, and I'm sure that zero Golden Eagles players are going to be a part of it.
Well, so then let's talk about the other game. And by the way, I don't mean any disrespect to Marquette when I say this, but all of the second tier games that we played, so we had all the games circled where it was like, all right, we got Duke, we got Virginia, we got Maryland, we got Denver. All of the like Drexel, Marquette's, this, that, they all kind of blend together. So I'm like 99% sure we went to Marquette, and it was one of those games where it's like, all right, fellas, let's change in the locker room. And they're like, locker room? You're going right under the bleachers, and we'll see you in about, you know, 2 hours. And so we're just like changing and like, all right, do we have to hold up a towel? Because there's like a guy walking over there. And I think it was Marquette, and it was one of those
cow carcasses are staring at us when we're changing.
Yeah, I don't want to upset the cows. It ruins the quality of the beef, and we don't want to get the Harley Davidson drivers riled up with our peak male physique. But it was just one of those games where it was like, all right, let's go into Marquette. Let's change under the bleachers. Let's beat them in their Super Bowl. Let's get out of here with like an 8-7 win that Corrigan's pissed off about because we didn't take care of business as much as we should have. And let's get out of here and go and enjoy a steak that was just dumped into a dump truck right on the other side of the road. So if that's the case, Marquette was kind of one of my favorite experiences. I'll talk about Drexel's experience where we had to change in a temporary building. And then the meanest heckles where it was like, ooh, don't yell at our trainers, like our student trainers, you Philly scumbag losers. So Marquette and Drexel have a special place in my heart. But that's not why we're here. We got to talk Georgetown Nova.
No, hold on real quick. Drexel's finest are incredible shit talkers, and they have been for 20 years. It's outrageous how good and how clever they are.
They had of the stats about Jerry Burns, like, college playing days, and I'm like, fellas, like you're making, and we thought about it. We didn't do it, but we thought about it. We were like, all right, guys, should we go practice low to highs from really low angles so that maybe we can hit one of these guys in the temple in the parking lot? We didn't do it because we're great guys and we're Catholic, and that would be against the word of the gospel. But it did. I was like, guys, we got to do something here. Like, we got to fling a ball over in that direction. So, yeah, Drexel's finest are the worst people I've ever seen. And they're ugly, too. So if you're listening to this and you're a Drexel lacrosse fan heckling from the parking lot, you're stupid and ugly and mean. Now try to have a good day. But Georgetown Nova. Georgetown,
that's the nicest thing that has ever been said to them.
Yeah. They're saying things about my mother, and I'm like, yeah, well, you're ugly. It was literally my comeback. That's my favorite comeback, by the way, when people be like, damn, you really missed that shot. I'm like, years after this game is over, you're going to forget about that shot, but you're still going to be ugly, and I feel bad for you about it. And that was always my favorite thing to say. So Georgetown Nova. Georgetown with the comeback story of the season. They lose their first three, and I hope we can scrub the tailgate podcast from right after that, because I said, this team's done. Dordovic hit the sun on a transfer pass. We got to get these guys out of here. What do? They win their next 10 games in a row. Absolutely unreal. So the best of the Big East in a 12-8 victory over Nova, as Dordovic went 4-1 and helped Georgetown start hot, which they took a 5-3 lead into half. That became 7-4. And similar to, I think it was the Yale-Harvard game we were talking about, it just kind of felt like the 2-goal buffer, the 4-goal buffer was just present the entire time. So jumping out to a lead, not letting Nova get within one, I believe. And it isn't official. It's not 100% certain, but it's looking like it's going to be Georgetown-Providence and Nova versus DU. Someone honestly needs to dethrone Georgetown.
No, that's official.
Oh, it's official now?
Yeah, it wasn't official on Friday night. It took Providence beating St. John's in order for that to be official. But it is,
got it.
Because that happened on Saturday.
Now that's official. Georgetown is going to play Providence. Villanova is going to play DU. What I was saying is we need someone to dethrone Georgetown, because if they go into the tournament with a 12-game win streak, that becomes a very dangerous team. And, I mean, Big East, who knows, Terry?
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't have a lot to add to this game. I was going to go, except that the forecast was terrible, so I didn't want to sit in the rain the whole time. And it unfolded very much like Georgetown-Villanova games prior to it have unfolded. I saw the Hoyas play 2 weeks ago against Loyola, and I did something that I have never done before, but I actually requested that an offensive or an assistant coach come to the press conference, because after Georgetown Notre Dame, when I covered that game, and when we were talking to Kevin Warren afterwards, you know, basically he was just saying, like, we lost to Hopkins and Penn, but we played well enough that we didn't feel like we needed to make changes. But the manner in which they lost to Notre Dame was so dramatic that this is like, we're 0-3. This is the time that we're going to make drastic changes. So what I wanted was, all right, 2 months have elapsed. You have made changes, but also not like a ton, right? Like if you look at their personnel, if you look at their systems, all that other stuff, it's not as if they've like benched Tucker Dordovic or Graham Bundy or whatever. So, you know, they made changes, but they were more subtle. And that's why I wanted John Hogan, the offensive coordinator, to be able to speak to what those changes actually were. And basically all they said was it was time. And it's so many different, you know, if you think about it in the context of, all right, you've got an offensive coach and then a bunch of players, then it creates all these individual relationships and associations. And then all of these relationships and associations get compounded, right? So like, you know, just say it's a group of 15 people and, you know, you and I represent one relationship. It's 15 times 15. I mean, it's a huge number of relationships and familiarity that needs to be developed. And it takes time is essentially what they said. And the time has elapsed. And now the question is, all right, how good are you actually, right? You haven't played a Penn or a Hopkins or a Notre Dame since you played those three teams. Now we get to see it. And it'll be exciting. I mean, you know, obviously we have to see them play the Big East tournament before we see them play an NCAA tournament game. But they're going to be in, and we're going to find out if they're better than they were last year when they lost to Delaware in the first round.
That's what I like about some tournaments is figuring out who's going to be in, who's going to be seeded. And then for a team like Georgetown, listen, you're already in, but what kind of momentum and what kind of performance statements? And honestly, I think from a fan perspective, it's fun to just watch momentum, but also from like a coaching perspective, what are you putting on film heading into the tournament? Like, are you showing weaknesses? Are you, you know, are you putting together games that, you know, make it really difficult? Because everybody's going to be watching, you know, especially for the teams that have already clinched and that aren't playing and that aren't in conference tournaments. You know, I speak through a lens of Notre Dame, who only has UNC, but is already like, all right, we should be paying attention to some other stuff. So it's always interesting, this little chess match of what are your last 2 to 3 games, especially in the conference tournament, look like versus what else have you put on film over the course of the season. And I would love to see Georgetown just come out and, you know, show a bunch of their weaknesses in the conference tournament, make it easy for the other teams that they're matching up against. But credit to them. And anything else on the Big East before we move on to the Big Ten?
Big to big, baby.
So Maryland Rutgers and a battle of two teams. We're called the tailgate. As far as two teams you want to attend a tailgate for, these are top five for sure. You know, you get blue crabs or a meatball sub, I'll take two, a win-win. But Maryland comes away with a 14-11 energetic win, and we'll tab this as a bounce back after losing to Hopkins last week, and it's timely because that's the matchup that they have in the tournament. So Hopkins, Maryland at Homewood, get your popcorn. And it was a balanced approach. Daniel Kelly had four. Braden Irksa had 6 assists, and Weirman at the X. It was a team effort. But I feel like it comes down to, in the absence of Ajax Zapatello, and we certainly hope that he's okay, John Tillman said that there was optimism that he's going to be able to play again at some point in the next couple weeks. I feel like it just came down to moments like Brett Makar stinging a corner and them celebrating so much that it got a penalty. So I feel like Maryland rode momentum, excitement, and in a bounce back game, manufactured energy to a win over Rutgers, and holding Rutgers scoreless. I feel like this was the point of the game, and why I brought up Ajax Zapatello's absence is because even with one of the best players in the country on the sidelines, they held Rutgers scoreless for over 21 minutes, starting in the second quarter and ending in the fourth. And that is not something that you can come back from, unless, you know, there's an act of God involved. So this 14-11 win, good energy by Maryland, a really good defensive performance by Maryland, and now we get to see the Big Ten tournament shape up.
Yeah, I mean, do you want to describe what happened in the Michigan-Ohio State game? Because I think it's actually easier to talk about these two in conjunction with each other.
Yeah, sure. So Michigan-Ohio State, the Michigan officially owns the Buckeyes for the second time this year, and they won 14-10. And because Michigan can seemingly never play a normal game, they decided to score 11 of their 14 goals in the first half. And a big reason why they came away with the victory was goalie Shane Carr, 14 saves and some big saves at that. And I feel like this wasn't terribly shocking, as Michigan has proved themselves to be a contender, but to just be consistent and not have that Marquette-esque setback or that head-scratcher late into the season is making Michigan a very formidable foe. And we have a battle of, I would say, bounce-back programs, because Michigan is going to be tabbed up against Penn State in my personal favorite matchup of conference tournaments. Yeah, I know you have Maryland Hopkins. I know you have all this stuff. But Michigan-Penn State having big ramifications on not only who's going to play in the Big Ten, but it's just cool to see Michigan as a part of this cool storyline alongside that. So Michigan races out to a lead against Ohio State. Good goaltending helps them nurse that lead. Although their offense went a little bit silent in the second, and in contrast to what we just talked about with Maryland holding Rutgers scoreless for 21 minutes, that's how the Big Ten played out this weekend.
Yeah, you're right to distinguish between the ways in which the games unfolded a little bit, in the sense that Maryland kind of pulled away and Michigan kind of just coasted, I guess, a little bit. But the reason I want to talk about them collectively is because I think that there was something in common with Maryland and Michigan, and there was something in common with Ohio State and Rutgers. And it was essentially like the belief that each team could and was going to win on both sides of the equation. And, you know, I don't think that this was necessarily a fait accompli, but I do think that Ohio State whenever I watch that team, I'm like, this is a team that struggles to believe that they can win because of their situation at the faceoff X. And even against Michigan on Saturday, it manifested because early on, when they were roughly 50-50 through the first half, it felt like the rest of the roster didn't show up. And I attributed it to the fact that they didn't think that they had a shot, because they didn't think they were going to win faceoffs. So then when they started winning faceoffs, it was almost like, oh no, now we have to compete. It was a weird vibe and a weird dynamic. And, you know, they weren't making saves. And then for Rutgers, obviously, the series is really one-sided against Maryland. They have to go back to College Park. And, you know, ultimately, the fact that Ajax Zapatala was a late scratch didn't prove to be an opportunity that Rutgers was able to take advantage of. So, you know, essentially, here we are, where I'm not ready to say that Rutgers doesn't have a shot at an at-large bid. But I'll put it this way. I think their resume is far inferior to Harvard's resume, and they were both number 15 in the RPI, assuming that that's where Rutgers stays, you know, not playing again this season before the end of the regular season. They don't have a top five win. They have three top 20 wins, which is the same number that Harvard had. So it's still, I guess, possible, but it doesn't seem likely when you compare them to the other teams in that bubble conversation and try to isolate, like, whose resume is better than another's. And then Ohio State, not eligible at under 500. So I think those were the factors.
It's interesting, too. Well, I was just going to make the point that Ohio State not having this belief that they can win, and I'm making a guess here, but Coach Myers is notoriously a very hard-nosed, grinding coach. And when that's going well, that gives a team resilience. But when it's not going well, that very likely could be a reason that this team, when they take the field, looks, I don't want to say beat down, and I don't want to disservice Ohio State, because I think they're a pretty darn good lacrosse program. But when there's a hard-nosed coach and when things aren't going well, I can't imagine that practices are fun. And it seems like a team that is likely walking into practice Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and just taking a big melancholy sigh before they take the field and probably get torn up. I would have to talk to an Ohio State player, and I would have to probably omit their name and get the true sense of their locker room. But I couldn't agree more that it looks like a bit of a defeated locker room, and that begs the question, why? And I think that that might be, you know, there's the split of a hard-nosed coach, and when things are going well, they get exponentially more resilient and hard-nosed and, you know, to an extent, even chippy, and you just dread playing a team like that. Versus this is a team that I wouldn't be surprised in the Michigan locker room. They say, if we start out good and if we get to a good spot in this game, it's going to go reverse and it's going to go exponentially worse for Ohio State, and it's not a team that they can believe in themselves enough to mount a comeback. That's my guess.
I think there was a lot of wisdom in that guess.
I just got told by Terry Foy that I have wisdom, and that's going right on my resume. We might have to cut so that I can update my resume, and it just starts with Nick Osello. Terry Foy said that I have wisdom in one of my guesses.
There you go. All right, let's talk about the game of the weekend.
No, before, I just want one prediction. Who wins the Big Ten?
Hopkins.
I got Michigan, and you owe me a case of beer from a prediction earlier that I can't remember. I think it was Syracuse beating Princeton, UNC. Right? UNC, I thought. For the bottom of the barrel. So, wow. I'm parched over here.
Double
Terry,
or nothing?
So interest kicks in. Interest kicks in soon. Let's go double or nothing. Michigan at least goes further than Hopkins and ultimately wins it.
No. We'll push it if neither wins. Oh, right. Yeah. No, perfect. It's fine. Yeah. If neither wins, it's a push. But if Michigan advances and Hopkins doesn't, then even if they lose in the championship game, you still win the bet. So, yes, I'm good with that.
All right, perfect. Gosh, I'm just so thirsty over here. And the game of the week, and ladies and gentlemen, if you didn't watch this, go back and watch it. Merrimack versus Bryant. Now, Merrimack is a program dear to my heart. But go back and watch the last, just the second half. We saw an absolutely massive hit. We saw a goalie goal. We saw a deep hole goal on the 10-man ride. We saw Bryant mount a comeback. We saw Merrimack mount a reverse
goal.
Comeback. A disallowed goal. Honestly, it was an entire...
We saw so much shit-talking.
I'm surprised nobody took a swing. I was like, somebody has to start a fight here because this is an exorbitant amount of trash talk, and that's even coming from me, a guy who ran his mouth way too much and never backed it up.
And
so,
also took a swing
Merrimack
in a game.
And also took a swing once, allegedly. That was photoshopped. Sorry, Blaze. Love you, buddy. Merrimack Bryant with the surprise game of the week, and as the game unfolded, Merrimack jumped out. Bryant mounted a comeback, and then the second half saw a season's worth of defining moments. And to me, the MVP of the game was number one, Michael Ferrara. I just thought he played a really good game. There is no bias there. I think he has a great sister. And, that was one of my big takeaways, is not only was this a fantastic game, but Michael Ferrara played kind of hero ball throughout. And Henry Vogt is nasty. I hope he doesn't hit the transfer portal and is the staple of Merrimack for the next, what is he, a freshman or sophomore, next 2-3 years?
Sure. I don't know. He was our either play of the week winner, like in week zero. So yeah, this game ended at the perfect time for me to turn it on. Like after the other, you know, earlier starting games ended, but before the other later starting games started. And I wasn't surprised that there was going to be juice because due to conference realignment and Merrimack classifying from D2 to D1, they're still ineligible for the postseason, the NCAA tournament, and everything like that. So even though they're pretty good and they should be in contention, they're not. And so this was kind of their Super Bowl, and they were playing a Bryant team who I believe is the number one seed in the America East, or I don't remember how it shook out after they lost to Vermont. But all that being said, beating Bryant was going to be validating relative to that whole, you know, this being their Super Bowl type point. In addition to which, you know, the New England-ness of this is, it just kind of seeps out of every pore. So, I don't know that we necessarily need to go like too deep in terms of analyzing the play on the field. Although Ingoltz looks like a pro. That kid has an incredible frame and moves so fluidly for how big he is. So if you haven't seen Bryant play yet, check that out and keep an eye on him. He's far from the first pro lacrosse player to come out of the Bulldog program, but yeah, it was a hell of a win for the Warriors. And I don't know, I'm not ready to go this far, but they play Duke in Bethpage on Sunday. Duke has not blown teams out in this last day of the regular season game in the past. So just keep your eye on that. Just keep your eye on that.
And they're kind of historically consistent. What we know about Duke is they're going to take a piss down their leg in February, March, and lose to a Jacksonville or an Air Force. They're 100% going to beat Virginia. And then, like you said, it was always an interesting game. They know that they have it wrapped up. Merrimack's, I believe this is, the neutral site graduation game. They want to end their season with the bang. They're riding high. And if anything, expect a little scrappiness from America's sweetheart, Merrimack Lacrosse. And by the way, just a side note, did I ever tell you about the Merrimack tailgate I attended?
Yes, but tell the listeners again who didn't hear it the first time.
I would tell you, but I can barely remember a damn thing. Those parents are absolutely lethal with their cocktails, and expect a rowdy, hostile crowd from the Merrimack parents who almost... They almost be offended if you don't just consistently have a cocktail in your hand. So shout out to Merrimack parents. I hope it's a great game against Duke. Congrats on one of the best games of not only the weekend, but all season. And, you know, Terry, it's a good time of year. It's a really good time of year. Next episode, I would like to suggest doing superlatives, at least a couple of them. Maybe we get together, maybe we brainstorm who was the prom king. Who's the most likely to be, maybe we make up some wacky ones. My mind just went to a spot where I probably wasn't going to make an appropriate joke. But I think that'd be a great way to do the conference tournament play before the second season kicks off.
Love it, Nick. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review. Tell a friend. And we will be back next week with a superlatives episode of the Tailgate Podcast. Nick, love you.
Love you too, Terry. I'm going to go pack up some boxes. I'm going to get to moving. And I'm so excited. I'm getting settled into my own spot. And I want you to come visit me, and I love you.